crazy. When are you going to stop believing in something that isn't true?
When you stop believing in that fellow with the red suit and the white beard who goes, ho, ho, ho.
We are obviously separated by denominational differences.
Zoom a little, zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little, zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi there, welcome to this week's edition of My Science Project, the science and technology show. I am your host, Julia, and today's show is all about macabre science. Yes, in honor of Halloween, we're going to look at some weird and creepy science experiments. We'll also look at, in honor of All Saints' Day, which today is, a bit of science and religion, particularly the question that some scientists are trying to answer, which is there a God spot in the brain? In addition to that, we will have oodles of science events going on that you can participate in, both local and not so local, depending upon which province you live in, whether it's BC or Alberta. And of course, a seasonal mix of music. In fact, the first song is Susie and the Banshees with, surprise, surprise, Halloween. We'll be right back.
better way to celebrate Halloween in a scientific manner than to appreciate the weird ways in which scientists sometimes operate. Of course, science has been the subject of various horror stories, be it in book form, like Frankenstein, or film, such as Jaws. The idea that mankind fiddles with science in dangerous and unexplained ways, and nature takes its revenge in some form or other. Science has done some pretty great things. It's done some pretty horrific things. At least in the name of science, people have done some pretty horrific things. Generally, they haven't been terribly scientific in their actions, but there has been a fellow who has gone and actually cataloged different ways in which scientific experiments have been incredibly bizarre. Some with good reason, others mostly just indulgences, I think. Now, these stories that I'm going to share with you, and I'll share just a few, just a collection of some of the more creepy and appropriate for general radio consumption. These come from a book called Elephants on Acid and Other Bizarre Experiments. This is a book that was written by someone named Alex Berza, who actually has a master's in the history of science from UC San Diego, and began to generate his website about hoaxes and bizarre science experiments when he was writing up his doctoral thesis, which he later then decided not to pursue in favor of pursuing these weird science tidbits. As you might suggest, the book called Elephants on Acid actually does include the story of a scientific experiment done by giving elephants acid. I must preface that very few, if any, of these experiments were done terribly ethically. I have objections to, I think, all of them, as would, I'm sure, you, unless you happen to be a mad scientist. But I think that we can all appreciate these as being rather grim ways to spend one's scientific time and kind of amusing curiosities, but nothing that you should ever try at home, kids. No, these are things past done that we should learn never to do again, I think. The Elephants on Acid being a prime example of this. And in 1962, a group of Oklahoma City researchers decided to find out what happened when you gave elephants LSD. Now, these weren't, you know, left-of-center weirdos. This was actually involving the director of the Oklahoma City Zoo, who fired a cartridge syringe containing 297 milligrams of LSD into an elephant named Tusco. With the director of the city zoo were two scientific colleagues from the University of Oklahoma School of Medicine. So, you know, you'd think this was on the up and up. Now, 297 milligrams of LSD is a little bit more than you would normally take if you were to use this drug recreationally. It's about 3,000 times the level of a typical human dose. The researchers gave this much LSD because their rationale was that if they were going to give an elephant LSD, they better not give the elephant too little. This experiment apparently was designed to find out if LSD would induce something called must in an elephant. This is a kind of temporary madness that male elephants sometimes experience, during which time they become highly aggressive and secrete a sticky fluid from their temporal glands. Essentially, it's, I think, testosterone going into hyperdrive and has to do with mating seasons. So, unfortunately, the experiment didn't go so well. Tusco reacted to his LSD shot in the bum as if he had been stung by a bee. He trumpeted around his pen for a few minutes and then promptly keeled over onto his side, and about an hour later he was dead. The three scientists concluded, amazingly enough, that it appeared that the elephant is highly sensitive to the effects of LSD. Now, there was controversy, not about how they did the experiment, but over whether it was the LSD that killed Tusco or the drugs used to revive him. So 20 years later, a researcher at UCLA decided to settle the debate by, amazingly, giving two elephants a dose similar to what Tusco received. Now, of course, there's no mention about the ethics of deliberately trying to kill an elephant here. Reportedly, this fellow did have to sign an agreement promising to replace the animals in the event of their deaths. Now, unlike the previous experiment, this researcher mixed LSD into the water of the elephants, and when it was administered to the elephants in this way, they not only survived, but apparently they were not very upset at all. They acted sluggishly, they rocked back and forth and made some strange vocalizations, such as chirping and squeaking, but within a few hours, they were back to normal. This meant that the experiment was a resounding failure because the scientist was unable to tell whether or not the drugs actually had killed Tusco to begin with, or whether it was the drugs they wanted to use to revive him. Strange but true, folks. Strange but true. Here's one. It just gets weirder. In 1954, a fellow named Vladimir Demikov created a creature in his lab on the outskirts of Moscow by grafting the head, shoulders, and front legs of a puppy onto the neck of a mature German shepherd. Now, apparently he did a fairly good job of the surgery because the attached puppy head actually managed to drink, as did the German shepherd. They did an experiment where he showed them drinking milk. Unfortunately, these animals really weren't sustainable, and they ended up dying because of the experiment. The longest living two-headed dog was a month. Over the course of the next 15 years, Demikov actually created a total of 20 of his two-headed dogs. He explained that he was doing this with an ultimate goal of being able to learn how to perform a human heart and lung transplant. However, another surgeon ultimately beat him to his goal. In 1967, Dr. Christian Barnard successfully did this operation. However, Demikov, with his two-headed dogs, is widely credited for paving the way for it. Now, keeping along with the idea of dogs and heads, another scientist, a Soviet physician, again with the Russians, named Sergei Brukhonenko, developed a primitive heart-lung machine that he called an auto-injector. And with this device, he succeeded in keeping the severed head of a dog alive. To prove, when he demoed this experiment, that the head lying on the table really was alive, he showed that the dog had reacted to stimuli. For example, he banged a hammer on the table and the head flinched. When he shone a light into the eyes of the dog, the eyes blinked, and he even fed the head a piece of cheese, which promptly popped out the dog's esophageal tube on the other end. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's pretty gross. This one I found more funny rather than anything. I mean, this guy was definitely committed to his science. Stubbins Firth, a doctor in training in Philadelphia during the early 19th century, wanted to better understand yellow fever. He noticed that yellow fever ran riot during the summer, but disappeared in wintertime. As such, Firth concluded that it was not a contagious disease. Instead, he theorized that yellow fever was caused by an excess of stimulants, such as heat, food, and noise. To prove his theory, Firth set out to demonstrate that no matter how much he exposed himself to yellow fever, he wouldn't catch it. Well, this is how he did it. He started by making small incisions on his arms and pouring, quote, fresh black vomit obtained from a yellow fever patient into the cut. Amazingly, Firth didn't get sick. Next, he dribbled some vomit into his eyes. He fried some up on a skillet and inhaled the fumes. He fashioned some contaminated vomit into a pill and swallowed it. When none of that gave him yellow fever, he finally took to drinking entire glasses of pure and undiluted black vomit. And yet, he still did not get sick. Firth rounded out his experiment by, oh, the days before YouTube, by liberally smearing himself with other yellow fever-tainted fluids, including blood, saliva, perspiration, and urine. Healthy as ever, he declared his theory proven. A sample of one. Unfortunately, Firth was terribly wrong, as yellow fever is in fact very contagious and requires direct transmission into the bloodstream, usually by a mosquito, to cause infection. Hence, drinking and smearing contaminated fluids is probably not going to give you yellow fever. It's amazing that Firth actually pulled through, demonstrating his great commitment to his version of the scientific process. The next story, rather quickly, because I find this a rather despicable experiment. But in 1970, Robert Heath of Tulane University tried to convert a homosexual man into a heterosexual man. Essentially, Robert Heath allowed a young gay prostitute to stimulate himself using Teflon-covered electric transmitters put into his brain. The septal region is apparently the feel-good center of the brain, and when patient B19 was all wired up and allowed to trigger his feel-good region, he continued to do so and apparently became obsessed with the pleasure button. In one three-hour session, he pressed it 1,500 times until he was forced to be disconnected. Eventually, a female prostitute, with the permission of the state general, was introduced into the room with patient B19, and after an hour, when she finally initiated sexual interaction, it turns out that patient B19 and this prostitute had intercourse. According to Robert Heath, the head scientist, this was evidence of a successful conversion of a homosexual, and not terribly scientific at all. But it leads us to our next song. In the spirit of our transition over into science and religion, this is Morrissey, who I think is one of the very few artists in the world who could write a song entitled "I Have Forgiven Jesus," all about his experiences as a young gay man in a rather gay, unfriendly world.
I was a good kid. I wouldn't do you no harm. I was a nice kid with a nice paper round. Forgive me any pain I may have brought to you. With God's help I know I'll always be near to you. But Jesus hurt me when he deserted me, but I have forgiven Jesus for all the desire he placed in me, when there's nothing I can do with this desire. I was a good kid. Through hail and snow I'd go, just to moon you. I carried my heart in my hand. Do you understand? Do you understand? But Jesus hurt me when he deserted me, but Tuesday, suffocation. Wednesday, condescension. Thursday is pathetic. By Friday, life has killed me. By Friday, life has killed me. Oh,
desire. When there is nowhere I can go to offload this desire. Why did you give me so much love in a loveless world? When there's no one I can turn to unlock all this love. And why did you stick me in self-deprecating bones and skin? Why did you stick me in self-deprecating bones and skin? Do you hate me? Do you hate me? Do you hate me? Do you hate me? Do you hate me?
Holy smokes! I can't believe I'm part of the coolest club in the world!
Bub?
Yeah?
So, what club is that?
CITR! As a club member, I get ginormous discounts on the Friends of CITR card, which in itself, Timmy, I must say, is pretty amazing. I get dirt cheap prices at stores and shots I'm at all the time anyway! To be honest, it feels like being in a club within a club!
Wow! Hey, I want a Friends of CITR card!
You don't even have to be a member to get one. Although, clearly, you'd be that much cooler if you were a member. Go purchase your Friends of CITR card down at CITR. Or at special events they sponsor, such as concerts, membership drives, and shindig.
I got it. It feels like having special powers. I go into stores and bam! Discounts.
Tis what I said.
I'm a little concerned right now about your salvation and stuff. How come you have not been baptized?
Because I never got around to it, okay? I don't know why you always have to be judging me. Because I only believe in science.
Welcome back to My Science Project. I'm your host, Julia. Today's show is looking at macabre science and some science and religion-ish stuff. And we're wrapping up the macabre science bit. We just finished hearing some pretty grim science experiments. These are all from a book called Elephants on Acid and Other Bizarre Experiments. And if you'd like to read about the stories that I'm talking about on today's show, you can also visit the website, which is www.museumofhoaxes.com. To wrap up, there are three other weird experiments that I thought were worth sharing with you today. The first is, in keeping with the My Science Project unofficial mascot of a primate, and a monkey particularly. This is a story about a monkey head transplant. Yes, that's right, folks. When Vladimir Demikov, the fellow who created the two-headed dogs, revealed his creations in 1954, his work inspired a strange kind of surgical head race. Eager to prove that American surgeons, rather than Russian surgeons, were actually the best in the world, the government of the United States began funding the work of a fellow named Robert White, who then embarked on a series of experimental surgeries performed at his brain research center in Cleveland, Ohio. This resulted in the world's first ever monkey head transplant. The head transplant occurred in 1970. It took hours to separate a monkey's head from its body and to then reattach it to a new body. Now, funnily enough, when the operated monkey awoke and found that its body had been switched for a new one, I'm not sure how it knew that, but I presume you would know this about yourself fairly quickly. When it found out about the switch, it angrily tracked White with its eyes and snapped at him with its teeth. The poor monkey survived a day and a half before it died from complications due to its surgery. Nevertheless, Robert White soldiered on, campaigning to raise support for a human head transplant. He toured with a fellow named Craig Vitovitz, a near quadriplegic who volunteered to be the first to undergo the procedure. Somehow this story makes stem cell research seem oh so much more attractive. The second last weird science experimental story involves, very appropriate for Halloween, it's very Frankenstein, it involves the electrification of human corpses. In 1780, the Italian anatomy professor named Luigi Galvani discovered that a spark of electricity could cause dead frog limbs to twitch. This then spawned the question, what would happen if you applied electrical currents to a human cadaver? Galvani's nephew, Giovanni Aldini, embarked on a tour of Europe in which he offered audiences the chance to see this rather stomach-churning spectacle. His celebrated demonstration occurred in 1803 when he applied the poles of a 120-volt battery to the body of an executed murderer. When Aldini placed wires on the mouth and ear, the jaw muscles quivered, the murderer's features twisted up in his face, his left eye opened. It's all very grim. For the so-called grand finale, Aldini hooked one wire to the corpse's ear, and this really isn't G-rated, plunged the other wire up the corpse's rectum. The corpse proceeded to break into what appeared to be a very hideous dance. Other researchers have tried electrifying bodies with the specific hope of restoring them to life with no success. It's believed that early 19th century experiments of this very kind are exactly what Mary Shelley was inspired by when she wrote her 1816 novel entitled Frankenstein. The last story is kind of Edgar Allan Poe-ish, involving heartbeats at death. In 1938, a fellow named John Deering was sentenced to death. He had volunteered to participate in an experiment, however, the first of its kind, to have his heartbeat recorded as he was shot through the chest by a firing squad. The prison physician figured that since Deering was being executed anyway, science might as well benefit from the event. The electrocardiogram of this convicted prisoner immediately disclosed that despite Deering's calm exterior, his heart was beating like a jackhammer at 120 beats per minute. When the sheriff gave the order to fire to end Deering's life, his heartbeat raced up to 180 beats per minute. Interestingly, the rhythm gradually declined after he was shot through the heart, and 15.4 seconds after the very first shot, Deering's heart stopped altogether. They concluded that, in fact, their prisoner was, despite his calm exterior, scared to death. Grim, 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 grim. To lead us into the next section of our show, where we look at whether or not there is actually a God spot in the brain, according to scientific research, this is Depeche Mode with an old song of theirs called Nothing. This is CITR 101.9 FM, and you're listening to My Science Project.
We'll be right back. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Can I have an extra piece of candy for my stupid brother? He couldn't come with us because he's sitting in a pumpkin patch, waiting for the great pumpkin. It's so embarrassing to have to ask for something extra for that blockhead Linus. I got 5 pieces of candy. I got a chocolate bar.
I got a quarter.
I got a rock.
Welcome back to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard the song Nothing by Depeche Mode, and that is a segue into the next bit of our show in honor of All Saints Day, which is today, November 1st. We're going to look at the question that some scientists have been posing of late. Is there a quote-unquote God spot in the brain? Of course, there is a long history and a history that persists today of conflict between science and various theological beliefs. It's not a conflict that we're really going to try and tackle today on the show. It's something that is incredibly complex, but certainly worth noting, particularly because of the increasing, it seems, conflation of science and religion, that is, the lack of separation in, for example, countries like the U.S., and even perhaps Canada, of trying to teach things that are non-scientific, such as creationism or intelligent design, in a scientific context. It's interesting that science and religion seem to have a conflict that stirs from a Judeo-Christian perspective. In large part, that's what we experience in the West, although I'm sure with the increased prevalence or visibility of other religions, including Islam, that we'll see kind of different dynamics and shifts in the science-religion conflict. Apparently in places such as Japan, where Buddhism is prominent, this isn't as big of an issue. In fact, it's thought that Buddhism and science are generally considered to be compatible with each other. Apparently the Baha'i faith also feels that there is a harmony between science and religion, and that this is a central tenet of this faith, and they reject the claim that these two things are in conflict. Some proponents of Hinduism also claim that Hindus are not afraid of scientific explorations nor of technological progress, and that this poses no threat to their belief system. I think it's a largely personal thing, but there's no doubt that there certainly is institutionalized issues between science and religion. But it's important to remember that a lot of our great scientists were very spiritual people. For example, Charles Darwin, Isaac Newton, Faraday, the physicist, were devout. Einstein was at least a spiritual fellow, who in fact said in 1930 that, quote, "the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research." Apparently Pope John Paul II actually said that science and religion each bring out different aspects of reality, which is interesting coming from the Catholic Church, the same institute that seriously condemned Galileo for saying that the Earth was not the center of the universe just a few centuries ago. But having said all that, and you know, if you have any thoughts about all this stuff that you want to communicate to me, Julia, or to my co-host, Anne, feel free to get in touch with us. You can email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. But as I keep promising, we're going to look at some new research that's looking for a particular area of the brain that is meant to be linked up with religious experiences. There's a researcher, a neuroscientist named Mario Beauregard, who works out of the University of Montreal. Now, he did a study recently using 15 Catholic nuns and exposed them to something called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, to see changes in brain activity according to various experiences that these nuns had. And Beauregard was seeking to pinpoint the brain areas that are active when the nuns recalled the most powerful religious epiphanies of their lives. So his question very much was, is there a God spot in the human brain? Using fMRI and other tools of modern neuroscience, researchers are attempting to pin down what happens in the human brain when people experience mystical awakenings during prayer and meditation, or during spontaneous utterances inspired by religious fervor, or in other words, speaking in tongues. Now, such efforts to reveal the neural correlates, if you will, of the divine are being called neurotheology and spiritual neuroscience. The idea behind this work is that not only might these data reconcile science and religion, but they might also help point to ways of eliciting pleasurable otherworldly feelings in people who do not have these feelings or who cannot summon them at will, which bears the question of do people really need these things to be healthy and fulfilled? But apparently this is the tack that these researchers are taking. Ultimately, neuroscientists study this question because they want to better understand the neural basis or mechanical basis of a phenomenon that plays a central role in the lives of so many people. In this way, they equate the study of the God spot as being as equally important as studying the neural basis of emotion, memory, or language. Now, there's a long history to the speculation that religious feeling has a specific place or home in the brain. In 1892, textbooks on mental illness noted that there was a link between, quote, religious emotionalism and the disease epilepsy. In about 1975, neurologist Norman Geschwind of the Boston Veterans Administration Hospital first clinically described a form of epilepsy in which seizures originated as electrical misfirings within the temporal lobes of the brain, which are located on either side of the brain, over the ears. And epileptics who had this form of the disorder often reported intense religious experiences. If you happen to know someone who has this form of epilepsy, it would be interesting to ask them what their own personal experience is, if they also get this sort of religious moments. Now, neuroscientist Vilayanar Ramachandran of the University of California in San Diego reported in 1998 in a book called Phantoms in the Brain, which he co-authored with a journalist named Sandra Blakesley, that religious words such as God elicited an unusually large response in epilepsy patients. Hence, Ramachandran speculated that it could be the limbic system, which comprises the interior regions of the brain that govern emotion and emotional memory, that are somehow hooked up to this religious feeling. Now, going back to Canada, in Ontario at Laurentian University, a fellow named Michael Persinger sought to artificially recreate religious feelings by electrically stimulating that large subdivision of the brain that's linked in with emotion. He created something that he called, interestingly, the God Helmet. This helmet apparently generates weak electromagnetic fields and focuses them on particular regions of the brain's surface. This device has been trained on hundreds of people in Persinger's lab, and they managed to induce in these people a sense of presence, like someone else being in the room with them, even though there was no one else there. To me, this sounds kind of almost like paranoia or schizophrenia, but this apparently was sort of a comforting feeling, like they were not alone. So Persinger thus argued that religious experience and belief in God are merely the results of electrical anomalies in the human brain. Other people have tried to use this God helmet in their own research and have not been able to substantiate Persinger's claims, which is sort of neither here nor there, but doesn't bode too well for the work that he's trying to sell. In the University of Pennsylvania, another neuroscientist, Andrew Newberg, and his late colleague, Eugene Dakili, pointed to the involvement of other brain regions in some people under certain circumstances, In fact, they looked at Buddhist subjects. And when these Buddhist participants reported their own meditation peak, the state in which they lose their sense of existence as separate individuals, according to them, these researchers injected them with a radioactive isotope that is carried by the bloodstream to active brain areas during this meditation process. Interestingly, the researchers managed to track this to activity in the right prefrontal cortex of the brain. This area is particularly important because it normally aids with navigation and spatial orientation. So the neuroscientists working with these Buddhist participants surmised that because it was very quiet, this area of the brain was not active during Buddhist meditation. It underlied the perceived dissolution of physical boundaries, this feeling of being at one with the universe rather than being a separate entity. Going back to Montreal and Mario Beauregard's study of the Catholic nuns, his team found that six regions were actually invigorated during the nuns' recall of communication with God. Spiritual memory was accompanied by, for example, increased activity in the caudate nucleus. This is a small part of the brain to which scientists have ascribed a role in learning, memory, and recently falling in love. Another hot spot was called the insula, a prune-sized chunk of tissue tucked within the brain that monitors body sensations and governs social emotions. So according to Beauregard, there is no single one God spot in the human brain, although there could be various centers in the brain that mediate such emotional experiences. Now, what does all of this mean? Obviously, we experience things, everything in this world through our brain. And to be able to pinpoint various feelings to various parts of the brain is really a descriptive endeavor. It's labeling something to a particular mechanism. And this is a large critique of this neuroscientific religious research. A fellow named Seth Horowitz of Brown University, a neuropsychologist, says that you can list a bunch of places in the brain, and these neuroscientists seem to feel that if they can name this part of the brain that's active, they somehow understand it. But of course, this is not the case. Just by identifying an active center doesn't mean that you understand anything about what's going on. Another fellow who collaborated with Beauregard back at the U of M, named Vincent Paquette, goes further, and he actually likens this neuroimaging to something called phrenology, which was a Victorian practice where scientists tried and ultimately failed to intuit clues about brain function and character traits from irregularities in the shape of the human skull. This article is from Scientific American. It was an article that's published in print and online called Searching for God in the Brain at www.siam.com. And there were some comments made on that website to the similar effect that just by describing areas of the brain or identifying active regions really means nothing because in the grand context of things, everything gets filtered through our minds. It doesn't mean that anything is more or less real. And in fact, depending upon who was involved in various neurotheological studies, they saw this mechanistic evidence as either supporting their beliefs. The nuns were terribly excited to hear that various parts of the brain were active during their religious thoughts, whereas atheists tend to see this as evidence that God doesn't exist and that all of these religious feelings are artifacts of some kind of residual mechanism that's in the human mind for whatever reason. If you're interested in reading more about this, Scientific American also published an article. The Godspot article was published earlier in October, October 3rd, but there was also an article called Rational Atheism published August 19th of 2007 that talks about perhaps how science should go about negotiating with religion and trying to, I suppose the gist of it was, respect the freedom of everyone to believe what they feel they want to believe as long as no one is hurt in the process. And the crux of the article was the need for mutual respect of people who choose to hold religious beliefs and those who choose to hold atheistic beliefs, because as Timothy Ferris, and I'm sure other people have said, ultimately atheism is itself a belief. I teased you at the top of the show with a litany of science events that are happening in and around town. That would be Vancouver. And a couple things that are going on here over in Calgary, too. So let's get to it, because there's several that I think are quite cool and worth getting involved in. The first of which is, and you've probably heard this one before, but Café Scientifique. That's right, Café Sci, of which event Anne is a co-organizer, happens on Tuesday, November 13th. Lucky number 13, huh? Keeping up with this sort of creepy Halloween theme. The topic of this month's cafe is Viruses Rule the World, Stories from the High Seas. It's a talk that will be given by Dr. Curtis Suttle of the Department of Earth and Ocean Sciences at UBC. Cafe Sci happens, as ever, at the Railway Club, which is located at the corner of Dunsmuir and Seymour Streets in downtown Van Groovy. 7:30 p.m. is the kickoff time. Show up early for food and drinks if you like. It's tasty. And, of course, the event is completely, absolutely, utterly free. If you want more information, please visit the Cafe Sci website, which is www.cafesci-van.com.